Chapter 11. While still gathering facts about JFK's assassination, Dorothy Kilgallen watched television coverage at 11:15 a.m. on November 24th of the transfer of Lee Harvey Oswald, born in New Orleans in 1939, from one jail to another. As Oswald emerged from an elevator, Kilgallen noticed two detectives flanked the grim-faced murder suspect. One journalist of those scattered about shouted, "Here he comes!" Believing Oswald, named after his father, Robert E. Lee Oswald, responsible for the death of the president, Kilgallen glowered at the alleged assassin. Kilgallen noticed Oswald was handcuffed to the left wrist of one detective. He turned out to be J.R. Jim Lavelle, dressed nattily, in a white suit and a gleaming white Stetson hat. Beside him, the second detective, whom Kilgallen would learn was L.C. Graves, held Oswald's left arm. No officers stood directly in front of Oswald, 5'9" or so, and of slight build, as the bevy of reporters and photographers rushed in. Television camera operators focused on the hectic scene. At exactly 11:21 a.m., they heard reporter Ike Pappas ask, "Lee, do you have anything to say in your defense?" A few seconds later, as Kilgallen's eyes scanned the scene, a stout man wearing a nap-brimmed gray fedora, later identified as Jack Ruby, edged closer to Oswald from behind a swarm of reporters. Like millions of others, Kilgallen watched in disbelief as the man extended a handgun and, from a distance of about 15 inches, pulled the trigger. The gunshot caused Detective Lavelle, his eyes reflecting disbelief, to recoil in horror. Robert Jackson snapped his Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph at this moment. Kilgallen winced as Oswald moaned in anguish. Shocked by the unfolding chaos on the television screen, she watched as police pounced on the assailant. "What?" she thought. "Two assassinations in 3 days? No, it can't be." At the exact time Oswald was dying in Dallas, famed San Francisco attorney Melvin Belli enjoyed lunch with his friend J. Kelly Ferris at Skoma's restaurant at Fisherman's Wharf. Belli was a bigger-than-life character who San Francisco attorney Frederica Sayer told the Chicago Tribune was like a big howitzer. You had to point him in the right direction. Over the span of 60 years of practicing law, Belli represented famous personalities such as actors Errol Flynn, Lana Turner, and Mae West, and boxers George Foreman and Muhammad Ali. Other clients included the Rolling Stones, comedian Lenny Bruce, and mobster Mickey Cohen. At the height of Belli's popularity, his associate Kent Russell penned a song about his mentor titled "Lone Ranger in a Three-Piece Suit." The first stanza read, "Back in 55, the magazine of Life crowned him the king. Juries were his subjects, and verdicts they did bring. He was help for the helpless as he traveled far and wide. Claims agents and adjusters saw Robin Hood alive. Taken from the powerful, the reckless, and the cruel, awarding to the injured, the beggar, and the fool." A chorus followed. "Lone Ranger in a three-piece suit, and trial was his game. His calling card read lawyer, and Belli was his name." As Belli spoke with Ferris, a friendly waiter walked by and told Belli that a man named Jack Ruby had killed Oswald. Ferris told this author that Belli, called by Life magazine the King of Torts for his prowess as a personal injury attorney, boasted, "Well, since Oswald's dead, I'll have to defend Ruby." Perplexed by the comment, Ferris asked Belli to elaborate. He did not do so. Certain the killing of Oswald confounded logic, Kilgallen began to investigate the man she had learned was Ruby. She wondered why he was present in the Dallas Police Department basement garage for Oswald's transfer. Within minutes, she reached out to reliable sources in the department, looking for answers. Meanwhile, Jack Ruby, while being led to his jail cell, asked Detective Don Ray Archer if Oswald was dead. Recalling the conversation, Archer said, "Ruby's behavior to begin with was very hyper. He was sweating profusely. I could see his heart beating. He asked me for one of my cigarettes. I gave him a cigarette. Finally, after about 2 hours had elapsed, the head of the Secret Service came up, and I conferred with him, and he told me that Oswald had died. This should have shocked Ruby because it would mean the death penalty. I returned and said, 'Jack, it looks like it's going to be the electric chair for you.' Instead of being shocked, he became calm. He quit sweating. His heart slowed down. I asked him if he wanted a cigarette, and he advised me that he didn't smoke. I was just astonished at this complete difference of behavior from what I had expected. I would say his life had depended on him getting Oswald." On the morning of November 25th, Kilgallen, ever inquisitive about the assassinations, made plans to visit Dallas. At the same time, J. Edgar Hoover issued a memo to the Dallas Police Department. It stated that FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. should receive all DPD files. In essence, Hoover and the Bureau had taken over the investigation. More to the point, the FBI director had begun his campaign in full force to convince the world that absolutely no conspiracy was responsible for JFK's assassination. In a November 24, 1963 FBI memorandum, made public by the U.S. government in October 2017 as part of a partial JFK files release, Hoover expressed hope for a confession from Lee Harvey Oswald at the hospital before he died. Since that confession never happened, Hoover directed his agents to have something issued so that we can convince the American public that Oswald is the real assassin. Unbeknownst to Kilgallen, Hoover also called White House aide Walter Jenkins. He told him, "The thing I am most concerned about, and so is Mr. Katzenbach, Deputy Attorney General, is having something issued so we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin." Hoover instructed FBI Associate Director Clyde Tolson to prepare a memorandum to the Attorney General setting out the evidence that Oswald was responsible for the shooting that killed the president. On November 25, 1963, less than 2 years before Kilgallen's death, JFK's funeral took place in Washington, D.C. Representatives from 90 countries attended. Kilgallen, watching on television, wept at the death of her friend. Following his appearance at the funeral, Robert Kennedy walked the grounds at his home in Virginia with his favorite dog, Brumus, a black Newfoundland. RFK's head bowed. He was stricken with grief. He had lost his brother, his best friend. The next day, Kilgallen read a press release from J. Edgar Hoover at FBI headquarters. "Not a shred of evidence has been developed to link any other person in a conspiracy with Oswald to assassinate President Kennedy." Kilgallen shook her head in disbelief. Hoover, it appeared, was intent on closing any government investigation before it began. At the Journal American offices, readers flooded Dorothy Kilgallen's desk with various theories about the JFK assassination. In her Voice of Broadway column, she wrote, "I wish I could acknowledge all of the letters, but it is impossible. So I hope those who wrote to me in the days following my columns on President and Mrs. Kennedy will accept my heartfelt thanks now." While Kilgallen pored over correspondence, Dallas County Assistant District Attorney Bill Alexander, a tart-tongued, razor-thin, Wild West type of prosecutor, who said he honed his tough-guy courtroom tactics while serving in the Army infantry in campaigns in North Africa, Italy, France, and Germany, readied his case against Jack Ruby. He told this author he was surprised JFK was dead, stating, "I had heard RFK was going to be killed, because as many people as he had screwed, ones like local law enforcement that he stepped all over, or with people he hadn't kept his word with, underworld people like Carlos Marcello, politicians and the like. He just had too many enemies, many more than his brother. As Alexander, who normally carried a gun even when he was in the courtroom, ruminated about JFK's demise, Kilgallen continued to receive information about Oswald and Ruby from her Dallas contacts. An assassination investigation file she had created thickened. Kilgallen was determined to probe the DPD and FBI investigations. She wanted to make certain the public learned all of the facts. In a Dallas Morning News Wire story, Kilgallen learned of the headline, "Famous Attorney Melvin Belli to Represent Jack Ruby." Kilgallen was suspicious and used her San Francisco contacts to investigate. She learned Belli's practice focused exclusively on civil cases instead of criminal matters. He had not tried a murder case in years, and never one with the death penalty at stake. The information made her wonder why Belli had been retained to represent Oswald's killer. Kilgallen made plans to attend Ruby's trial. At her townhouse, Kilgallen watched television coverage of Belli arriving at the Dallas airport. Reporters flocked to his side. He announced his representation of Ruby by telling the media Earl Ruby, Jack's brother, had hired him to represent Jack. Later, Belli made several inconsistent statements regarding how he became Ruby's attorney in two different books he wrote, Dallas Justice and My Life on Trial. One version alleged that Earl Ruby watched him in an L.A. courtroom and was impressed enough to ask that Belli represent Jack Ruby. This proved to be false. When asked by this author about how Belli became Ruby's lawyer, Belli's associate Seymour Ellison attributed it to a call from a Las Vegas businessman, someone in the entertainment industry. Belli, who once called J. Edgar Hoover a fatuous old dictator, alleging that he has set up a little stormtroop empire, never mentioned his mobster client and friend Mickey Cohen. Belli also failed to tell reporters he had represented Ruby's close friend and Cohen's girlfriend, stripper Candy Barr, at the request of Cohen before Judge Joe Brown a few years earlier. Candy Barr, stage name for Juanita Dale Slusher, was a top-name stripper who appeared in Las Vegas and also at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. At one point, she was engaged to gangster Cohen. Barr was arrested for narcotics violations and sentenced to a long prison term, with Judge Brown presiding and Bill Alexander prosecuting. Belli was hired to appeal the case. Within 10 hours after Ruby's shooting of Oswald, the FBI interrogated Candy Barr. The agents asked about her friendship with Ruby and any part in an alleged plot to kill the president. The interrogation lasted several hours. The next day, a Dallas Morning News article read, "Candy Barr, a well-known Dallas stripper who worked a few doors down from Ruby's strip club, told reporters she received a call from Ruby shortly before the JFK assassination. She said Ruby was trying to get in touch with Mickey Cohen or some other mobster. Ruby was certain that Juanita, or Candy, would know how." Brown was the same judge who would oversee the Ruby trial. Reporters thus neglected to connect Belli with Cohen or Barr. As will become clear, journalistic conduct as a whole was quite unprofessional, sloppy to be certain, regarding important facts about the JFK and Oswald assassinations, causing distortions of history for decades. In this instance, the reporters missed the opportunity to question whether, due to Belli's friendship with and representation of a dangerous underworld figure, the mafia could have been involved in the assassinations. A certain clue would have been discovered if journalists had checked Belli's FBI file. A March 18, 1960 memorandum secured by this author under the Freedom of Information Act involved a motor trip Belli took with two individuals, one being Mickey Cohen, to Las Vegas on April 23, 1959. The report stated, They appeared at the Clark County Sheriff's Office, where Cohen was required to register as an ex-felon. Mr. Belli stated at that time that Mr. Cohen was in Las Vegas transacting some legal business, and also to discuss a golf tournament to be held at Wilbur Clark's Desert Inn Hotel golf course. On November 29, 1963, Kilgallen noted with interest President Lyndon Johnson's formation of the Warren Commission, headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren. It would investigate the JFK assassination. Kilgallen examined the list of commission members. She began background checks on each one. Without exception, every journalist focusing on what had happened in Dallas appeared satisfied with J. Edgar Hoover's official statement that it was Oswald and Oswald alone who assassinated JFK. Kilgallen had strong beliefs to the contrary. Ever defiant when she believed any sort of cover-up happened, Kilgallen decided to question the official investigation with the dogged determination she had employed during other high-profile cases, including the trial of Dr. Sam Shepard. Troubled by the circumstances surrounding the assassinations, and despite Mark Sinclair's telling Kilgallen to tread lightly with her criticisms of those who were officially investigating JFK and Oswald's deaths, her column launched what would become a full-scale investigation on her part. It would last until the day she died, since Kilgallen was not intimidated by the danger she might face by posting controversial articles about the assassinations. This was a departure from many journalists who admitted being scared to cross hairs with official government statements. One in particular was Thayer Waldo of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He allegedly had credible information that Bernard Weissman, one of those responsible for a spacious billboard highly critical of JFK, Officer J.D. Tippit, who Oswald shot and killed almost an hour after the JFK hit, and Jack Ruby, met in Ruby's Carousel Bar 8 days before JFK's assassination. Waldo refused to print the story, or another, exposing the fact that Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry was surprised by the motorcade route, calling it vulnerable. Waldo, as an excuse, told attorney and author Mark Lane there would be real danger to him if he ran the articles. Undaunted, Kilgallen printed what Thayer had uncovered but was too scared to post. She would do so under the banner New Dorothy Kilgallen Exclusive, Tale of Rich Oil Man at Ruby Club. Later, on April 1, 1964, an FBI document would include the naming of an informant named Theodore Lee. He apparently had mirrored allegations made by Mark Lane, alleging that a week prior to the assassination of President Kennedy, a meeting took place at the Carousel Club in Dallas, Texas, which was attended by Mr. Bernard Weissman, Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit, and Jack Ruby. To the contrary, whoever filled out the document for the FBI wrote, "Our investigation has developed no information indicating that such a meeting ever took place or that such a meeting was ever likely." In 2017, when the government released documents included with the heretofore secret JFK files, they included a similar April 1964 memo from J. Edgar Hoover, ordering FBI agents to check out a report that Jack Ruby and Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit, fatally shot by Oswald shortly after Oswald killed Kennedy, had met at Ruby's strip club, the Carousel, sometime prior to the assassination. Regrettably, out of 552 witnesses called to testify at the Warren Commission, not one of them was asked about the alleged Weissman, Tippit, and Ruby meeting. The two April 1964 FBI memos make it clear that Kilgallen's column about the alleged meeting at Ruby's bar was a result of her deep probe into the details surrounding the death of JFK. At the very least, it made her suspicious and caused the reporter who feared no one to write a column entitled The Oswald File Must Not Close, on November 29, 1963, just 7 days after JFK was killed and 5 days after Ruby shot Oswald. It was a call to action loud and clear, directly attacking the official government statements being shouted to the world. At the outset, Kilgallen's strong words were aimed at the new president. She wrote, "President Lyndon Johnson has been elevated so swiftly to his new high post that in one sense, he has been snatched up into an ivory tower. As chief executive, he is no longer in a position to hear the voices of ordinary people talking candidly. If he could walk invisible along the streets of the nation and listen to ordinary people talking, he would realize that he must be sure that the mystery of Lee Harvey Oswald is solved and laid before the nation, down to the smallest shred of evidence." The next 6 words Kilgallen used were in complete opposition to those offered by Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry and J. Edgar Hoover, cheerleaders for the Oswald Alone theory. Kilgallen wrote, "If Oswald is President Kennedy's assassin, he is the most important prisoner the police in this country had in 100 years, and no blithe announcement in Dallas is going to satisfy the American public that the case is closed." Continuing, Kilgallen wrote, "President Johnson has directed the FBI to look into every aspect of the case, but he must go a giant step further. He must satisfy the public's uneasy mind about this peculiar assassination of the assassin, or he will start his term in office by making a dire political mistake that can cost him the 1964 election." In the next paragraph, she added, "The case is closed, is it? Well, I'd like to know how, in a big, smart town like Dallas, a man like Jack Ruby, owner of a striptease honky-tonk, can stroll in and out of police headquarters as if it was a health club at a time when a small army of law enforcers is keeping a tight security guard on Oswald." Security. What a word for it. Further making her case for a full-scale investigation, Kilgallen added, "I will not try to speak for the people of Dallas, but around here in New York City, the people I talk to really believe that a man has the right to be tried in court. When that right is taken away from any man by the incredible combination of a Jack Ruby and insufficient security, we feel chilled." Continuing her strong diatribe, Kilgallen wrote, "Justice is a big rug. When you pull it out from under one man, a lot of others fall too." Providing another indication of her suspicions, Kilgallen added, "That is why so many people are saying there is something queer about the killing of Oswald, something strange about the way his case was handled, a great deal missing in the official account of his crime. The American people have just lost a beloved president. It is a dark chapter in our history, but we have the right to read every word of it. It cannot be kept locked in a file in Dallas." Kilgallen's laundry list of enemies had expanded. It included the State Department, the CIA, the FBI, Fidel Castro supporters, the Russian government, and angered celebrities like Frank Sinatra. Added now were those who may have been involved in the John Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald assassinations. As to the latter, the red flag was waving. The most famous crime reporter of the time didn't buy the Hoover fabrication. She was on the prowl. Later, noted columnist and author Dominic Dunn summed up Kilgallen's state of affairs with those well aware of her star power. She had wit, power, and a mean streak. Everybody read her, and a lot of people were afraid of her. Dunn was right. Many people were afraid of Kilgallen, and with good reason, especially those who had masterminded the JFK assassination and those who were covering up the truth.